Well, thank you for inviting me, Peter, and pleasure to be here. And I'm going to talk about some of my work I've been doing with joint modeling. And so Peter asked me to sort of give a bit of an overview of joint modeling, and then I'll get into some sort of things which we've worked on and which we're currently working on. And some of the things I'm going to talk about are joint with some students, Menggang Yu and Wen Yi, and my ex-colleague who's talking next, Chi Hong Lin. Okay, so introduction, some sort of general description of joint models. This application to prostate cancer, some work we're currently doing on trying to be a little more semi-parametric, and then a brief list of possible research, open research issues. So here's the setting we're thinking of. So a clinical trial or an observational study, a medical type study, and my application is always whether there's a longitudinal variable, and that's a biomarker. It's some sort of measure of the disease. So it might be a measure of the immune system in an AIDS application, or measurement of PSA in a prostate cancer application. So what sometimes would be called an internal covariate. And I'm going to be focusing on situations where that's the continuous variable, not a binary or something like that. And then, so that's the longitudinal part of a joint model, and then there's a sort of survival part, a censored event time. So that would typically be sort of a clinically important event, you know, death or occurrence of a disease or recurrence of a disease following treatment. So that would be the typical censored survival time. So joint models are all about when you've got that sort of data and you want to sort of model that. So the data be summarized as the usual censored event time, T delta. Then imagine there's baseline covariates, X, and this time-dependent covariate, Y. So in this setting, both T and Y, both the time-dependent covariate and the event time are outcomes. And X could be things like stage of disease or treatment group or something like that. So I'm trying to formulate a model, so I'm going to sort of give you my view of how I like to formulate it. So there's a time sequence to how this data arises, and so that's going to play a role in how I think about formulating a model. So initially, there's, you know, your baseline information or the treatment group, and that's followed by this sequential observations of a biomarker, and then the event happens after that. So there's sort of a conditional time sequence going on how the data arises. And typically, there's an awful lot of prior knowledge, which generally I think as statisticians we don't really incorporate enough. But I mean, this data isn't collected in isolation. There's a bunch of people who've collected similar data before, studied the biology or studied the science. And so trying to incorporate that sort of prior information into the model is something try to do to the extent that you can. And you also, in terms of where you'd be applying this sort of model, the longitudinal variable you'd expect to be affected by X. So if X was a treatment in AIDS, you'd expect CD4 counts to be influenced by the treatment. And then the event of interest, say developing AIDS, is certainly expected to be associated with the biomarker. It's expected to be associated with CD4 counts. So this is just, so I listed at my approach, and I think there's lots of room for different approaches, but I just wanted to say I'm not saying this is the only way you can think about it, but this is how I think about formulating these models. So basically, there's an underlying multivariate stochastic process that generated the data. So in some sense, life's a multivariate stochastic process. So that's what's going on here. And so what we're trying to do here is just write down a model which is a description of that or an approximation of that, with the goal of trying to understand something about that process. So that's what a joint model is trying to do. And there's a scientific context, as I said, and that context probably leads to some assumptions, and so the type of things it might lead to a smoothness of something, or monotonicity potentially, or unimodal distributions, or in the setting I'm going to be talking about, the cancer setting, so tumors quite often grow approximately exponentially, so we might have exponential growth. The prior data might have suggested suitable transformations to use. So there's a whole lot of prior knowledge that you might try to incorporate. I try to make it the models are faithful to the time sequence. So you can't set up a model which conditions on a future event. And then once you've got that model, you've got this big general description, you can use it for a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of variety of inferences can follow. And we'll talk about those a little bit. and sort of more on the statistical end of things, probably just to actually deal with the model numerically, you better have statistical parsimony, not too many thousands of parameters. Models, just efficiency sort of matters as well as bias, so you want good estimation techniques. And one of the hardest things is actually to check where the data fits the model, which quite often no one checks. Okay, so here's the general model in sort of notation of the square bracket standing for the distribution. So the outcome variables are T, the event time, and Y, the longitudinal variable. So our goal is to give a general model for the joint distribution of T and Y, give them a baseline information. And you can imagine factoring that in two ways. One would be this way, which I'm showing you here. So this is a longitudinal model, a Y given X, and then a model for T, the event time, given the longitudinal variable of X. So that's the way I'm factoring it. You could also factor it as T given X, and then Y given T and X. But that would sort of, in my way of thinking, that would contradict the concept of being faithful to the time sequence. You can't sort of condition the longitudinal variable on the event which happens in the future. So that's why I choose to do it this way. So the longitudinal model has, there's lots of choices. There's lots of literature on how to formulate longitudinal models. Typically, there'll be random effects, there'll be measurement error. Most of the data I come across isn't totally designed, and so you get missing observations and unbalanced times of observations, so it's not a rigid data collection scheme. And then the hazard model, or the event time model, typically people have been using a time-dependent Cox model, modeling the hazard. And one of the problems here is that Y, the longitudinal variable, isn't fully observed. You've only got it observed at discrete times and variable times on each person. So exactly how you fit this sort of model when you don't have Y fully observed is a problem. And then issues of dependent censoring might arise too. Okay, so I said that one of the general goals here was to just give a descriptive model, and then you can use that model for lots of different possible outcomes or different possible conclusions. And so it may be your primary interest is in the survival analysis, the parameters of a hazard model. And that's actually what most people use joint models for observations Y, the longitudinal variable Y is typically not measured. And so if you wanted to just fit the survival model to these data, you're going to have a problem because you don't really have Y continuously measured. So people utilize a joint model to fill in the value of Y, and then you can fit this model. So that may be the goal. Or maybe you're interested in parameters of the longitudinal model. So by fitting a joint model, you're sort of taking into account the fact that some people are dropping out due to the endpoint. Or you may be interested in a marginal survival distribution of, say, T or T given X. Okay, so that's not an explicit parameter in the way I formulated the model, but the model could still be used to estimate that. And I think actually one of the later talks is going to be talking about that a little bit. So that's what number four means. So Y could be viewed as an auxiliary variable, some variable which you're not particularly interested in, but it might help in the estimation of a conditional or a distribution of T. So another use of joint models would be number five here, as a surrogate endpoint. So in the medical world, people are very interested in replacing the true endpoint with a surrogate endpoint, Y, replacing T with Y. So whether that's legitimate or not, maybe the joint modeling has something to say about that. And then number six is actually what I'm going to show you today, is once you set up a model, you can use it for prediction of individual patients. So a patient who's actually being followed, and you know sort of this joint distribution for the biomarker and the event time, patient being followed there, they haven't had the event yet, what's going to happen to them in the future? So the whole joint model framework can allow you to say something about predicting the future of that patient. So that's what I'll talk about. Okay, so that was in very general terms. A little more specific terms here. So this is a longitudinal model, typically a random effects model. So the observation for patient I at time Tij is usually assumed to be made up of a true value, Z, and a measurement error, EIJ. So that's sort of an act of faith to think that's a true value and it's a measurement error, but that's sort of a statistical construct. And then when you think about what the true value could be, it could depend on the covariates, and then there's some progression over time. So this is a random intercept, random slope model. And then typically AI and BI are assumed to be Gaussian. So that's a very standard longitudinal model. And then the hazard model says that the hazard at any time is a function of this Z, this true value of the person I at time t, plus maybe dependent on the baseline covariates as well. So that would be the description of a joint model. And you could have a baseline hazard as parametric or non-parametric here. And a variety of ways of estimation, maximum likelihood, and typically using the EM algorithm. I'm going to show you where we've done Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. Typically very computer intensive, takes hours to run sometimes. Not much standard software. There's some attempts to have different estimation schemes for this if you're just interested in very specific aspects of a joint model. If you're only interested in the hazard parameters, there's some choices about the estimation schemes, and they call conditional score method. But if you're interested in sort of a whole joint model, I think you more or less got to use these type of schemes. Okay, so what are some issues here? So if you remember, I had a random intercept and random slope. So that seems rather restrictive. Someone's has their own intercept and on their straight line forever. So maybe we could change that to be into some smooth function represented perhaps by a stochastic process, so fi of t. And I'm going to show you a little bit of what we've started to do with that later on. Another issue is there was this assumption these random effects are Gaussian. The hierarchical type model, they're Gaussian, so how robust would be the conclusions to that? And actually, more robust than you'd think. People have done a little bit of work with that and have looked at various true distributions and assumed normality, and things work out okay. So I don't know if that's such a big point always. And then another point, so the hazard is typically assumed to depend just on the current value of the biomarker. So that might be a context-specific issue to depending on whether that's good or not. So in an AIDS setting, you might think CD4 counts measure the immune system. Immune system's what drives you getting AIDS, and so it's just the current value of your immune system is all that matters. Whereas in a cancer setting, which I'm going to show you, what we'll actually see is that it's not only the current value, but it's how fast that's changing that really matters. And so, you know, tumors grow at certain rates, and what's going to happen in the future depends on what's happening now in terms of how fast it's growing, how aggressive the tumor is. So it might be more than just the current value of Z that matters. So it might be in some sense the history of the biomarker up to that point in time which matters more than just the current value. Or as I just said, slopes of Z might be another example. Okay, so that's sort of a background. So here's a very specific application, and I've talked about this before, so if any of you have heard some of this before, it'll be easier for you to follow this time. And a little bit of this is published, actually, in Journal of Clinical Oncology, a sort of a very applied version of this. So we have data from patients treated for prostate cancer with radiation therapy. It's one of the standard treatments for prostate cancer, and there's about 900 patients, and they have a bunch of baseline covariates, which are essentially measures of the stage and size of the cancer. And then there's this longitudinal marker, PSA, prostate-specific antigen. It's a blood test, and we'll see some pictures of it in a minute. Very easy to administer. It's used in lots of settings in prostate cancer. And then we have censored clinical event times. So those are, in this case, is recurrence of the disease. So they treat prostate cancer, it appears to go away, and then maybe for some people, you know, a year later, 5 years later, it comes back. So that's the event. So here's sort of a picture of the data, or just a subset of the data. So this is log of PSA, or log PSA plus 1, actually, on this scale. And this is time in months along here. And for the green people, they've censored. So they haven't recurred. And for the people in red, are the people whose cancer recurred. And basically it recurred, well, here are the times it recurred down here, but more or less at the end of their sequence. So you'll see some general pattern. I mean, everyone comes down initially, and then recurrence is preceded by the PSA increasing, whereas if there's no recurrence, the PSA tends to stay level. Essentially, many of these people are never going to recur. Either they really didn't have cancer to start with, or proper cancer, or you treated them so well that you've cured them. So that's the type of data. So we're going to be looking to model this data using a longitudinal model to capture this, these patterns and this variation in the PSA, and then a hazard type model to capture when these events occur. But you'll see, this obviously isn't a linear model here, isn't going to work. A random intercept with a straight line slope isn't going to work for these, because there's obvious decreasing and increasing pattern. And then there's a little bit more information about the longitudinal measurements. There's about 7,000 of them in total. People have a range of numbers of them, to average of 7 per person. About 12 years of follow-up, maximum of 12 years of follow-up. And these endpoints are clinical recurrence, or detectable disease, either locally through a biopsy, or the person gets distant metastasis, which is that's sort of the most serious one of these two. So 126 of these 900 are events, and 795 are censored. And the censoring is for a variety of reasons. I'm not really going to get into that too much. So the goals here, back to sort of the general goals, is just to develop a model which describes this data, describes sort of the aspect and the features of this data. And so that's going to be a model that relates the baseline variables, which things which are the size and stage of a disease, how PSA varies over time, and when they get a recurrence in the future. And then what we're going to try and do is make individual predictions for patients who've still been followed, haven't had a clinical event, what's going to happen for them in the future. So utilize the joint model to do that. We're only going to do that sort of 3 years into the future for each person. Okay, so this is sort of the idea of a model. I'm not going to go into too many formulas here, just a little bit in a minute. But the idea is actually, as well as that joint model I told you about, there's going to be a mixture going on here. We're going to distinguish or assume there are two groups of patients, a cured group and a non-cured group. And that happens at the time of treatment. They're either cured or never going to recur, and that sort of exists at the time of treatment. And if it doesn't, if they're not cured, then at some future time they will recur. So there's a latent variable for whether they're cured or not, so it's a mixture model. And then, so we're interested in what factors influence the probability of cure, and what factors influence the pattern of PSA, given they're cured or not cured. And then if they're not cured, what factors influence the hazard. So just a little more notation. So DI is going to denote the latent variable for whether they're cured or not. And of course, once I've collected the data for a subset of the people who have recurred, I'm going to know they're not cured. But for most of the people who are censored, I can't tell whether they're cured or not cured. So there's a model for the incident. So that's probability of cure, a logistic type model. And there's a model for the longitudinal data. Okay, so here, specify this. So there's a transformation applied to both sides. The basic model for PSA has this decreasing exponential plus an increasing exponential. So that decreasing exponential is to capture what happened at the beginning of the data, and the increasing exponential is to capture what happened at the end of the data. And those are going to be, there's random effects of these intercepts and these rates of changes. And we're going to have a separate model for the whether they're cured or not cured. And in fact, the cured group, basically the rate of increase of this increasing exponential is going to be set essentially to zero. Okay. And then the hazard model, or latency, time to the event model, the Cox model, or proportional hazards type model. So that's going to depend on this function's psi, and into psi we put in both the current value of PSA and the rate of change of PSA. Okay, so both of these things aren't directly observed from the data, but they're a consequence of the longitudinal model. So if you knew the longitudinal model parameters, you'd know what these values of PSA and this slope were, and those would be what you'd use in the model. Okay, so there's, 2.5 years of work of a doctoral student to get this to run properly using Markov chain Monte Carlo. So this is all summarized in this slide. but I much appreciated though. okay, so then you can do that. Actually, let me go to the next before I get to there. So there's lots of parameter estimates. There's like 30 odd parameters here. I'm just going to show you parameter estimates from a hazard model. So there's some baseline covariates which were part of a hazard model, and so these are the means and standard deviations from the estimated posterior distributions you get from a Markov chain Monte Carlo. And then this is sort of like a z-score, the mean divided by the standard deviation. So anything bigger than 2 here, maybe, that matters. So these baseline variables, some of them appear to matter, and the signs of these, whether negative or positive, or in sort of the directions we expect. And then these last two variables are the time-dependent variables we put in the model, and you'll see that the slope has a very dominant sort of effect here. So that rate of change is really driving the hazard. And the clinicians sort of knew that before. I mean, they work with that all the time. Okay, so that's just the estimation. So this is sort of a application of the model to do something at a more clinical level, if you like. So I want to predict recurrence for an individual patient. Patients in the clinic comes in, they haven't had a recurrence yet, they have a certain pattern of history of PSA, what can we say about their future? So we have all the prescription from this joint model to do that. So here's what we're trying to do. For patient I, the conditional probability of recurrence within A, which is probably TI less than TI plus A, given all the data. So they're sent, given their sensor at time TI. And so that's what we want to do. And I changed the sign here, that was a mistake. So what for each draw of the, given the parameters, which I just obtained from my Markov chain Monte Carlo draw, there's a formula from the model which tells me what this probability is. This conditional probability of TI residual time distribution is defined by a formula. So I can just add these up over lots of draws of my Markov chain Monte Carlo, and I have an estimate of this. Okay, so also you can estimate what might happen in the future for these patients, too, in terms of their longitudinal variable. And so this is, I don't know how clear this is. We'll just turn the lights off for a second so we can, because this is. All right, so you'll see there's some dots there and then some red pluses and there's a blue region. Okay, so the dots were the data we used, and and by the 2.5 years we got us to finish this, they'd actually collected more data on these people. So we fit models to the dots. And so these are just 4 examples of patients. And then we made predictions of what's going to happen for patients in the future. That's the blue shaded region. And then by the time we'd finished all that, they'd actually collected more data. And so that's the blue pluses. So, of course, they fall nicely in the regions. And in fact, I probably wouldn't show you them. They didn't fall in the regions. But in fact, these are supposed to be 95% regions, prediction intervals in a Bayesian sense. And if you can look empirically at how well we do, and we get about 93% of them in the region. So it's very well calibrated. Okay. And this is another set of 6 patients. So now we're talking about recurrence. When might the patient recur in the future? So this is the path of the patient, a particular patient, and then they're sitting at this point in time, and starting from that point in time, this is the beginnings of a estimated survival curve. So this blue line refers to this right-hand scale between 0 and 1 here. So if you look down at the bottom left, so this patient, we're predicting recurrence much sooner than, for example, patient number 3, who has this nice flat trajectory. Basically, there's no chance of recurrence within the next, I don't know, what we predicted out to 3 or 4 years out. So this is all something you can do from the model. Okay, so just a little bit of discussion of that, and then I'm going to turn to some of the new topics. So joint modeling is all about trying to understand relationships between the biomarker and the endpoints. I didn't show you here, but people have, well, you can try and do these things separately. You can try and look at the longitudinal model separately and the hazard model separately, and you actually correct for some biases and you gain some efficiency by doing them all together. Sort of as a commentary, these models are very parametric, so it might make one feel a little uncomfortable, and checking the model fit is non-trivial. Okay, so this is sort of some of the newer things we're working on a little bit. So this is an attempt to be a little more non-parametric in some aspects of a model. So if you remember previously, the longitudinal model had the ZI, the true thing, was a linear function of time, random intercept, random slope. So now we're thinking of it as a smooth population curve, and then each individual has their own curve. So that's a more general form for that model. And then within that, so the hazard model is the same as before, just depends on the true value or maybe with the slope. So F and W are now the way we're doing working on this, is to think of those as smoothing splines or integrated Wiener processes. And I'm not really going to go into the details of this, but this is with Ji Hong, who will be able to answer lots of questions about that. So the nice aspect of the longitudinal model here is if you express this as a smoothing spline, you can formulate it as a fairly standard mixed model, and so standard software could be used for the estimation. So that's, we're sort of taking advantage of that property. And up to now, what I've shown you is joint estimation. Estimate the hazard parameters and the longitudinal model parameters together. So now we're trying to get there, but we're at this point at the moment of actually doing them separately at the moment. So this is what's called two-stage estimation, not quite as good statistically. So we're going to fit the longitudinal model, and then from that get estimates of this true value. Those will be BLUP estimates, best linear and bias predictor estimates, which come out of just the classical mixed model framework. And then plug those into the hazard model and use standard partial likelihood. So that's the prescription. And so what values are we actually going to plug in? So we're going to show you a little bit of some simulation results and some applications to the data. So few different things you could do. What the FDA or the pharmaceutical industry does in this case isn't any of this modeling stuff. It just takes the last available observed value on the longitudinal variable and uses that in a partial likelihood. So that would be called last value carried forward. And then we're going to have two versions of imputation here. One we're going to call ordinary regression calibration, and the other one we're going to call risk set regression calibration. So both of those involve fitting those mixed models with smoothing splines, and it's just what data set the difference between the ordinary and the risk set calibration is what data set do you fit the mixed model to. So the ordinary regression calibration just fits the mixed model to the whole of a data set, and from that you can get a BLUP estimate of the longitudinal variable at the time you want, just from the one fit. So that in some sense might use. So if you're interested in imputing a value at 3 years for a particular person, then that's going to use the data, whether it's before 3 years or after 3 years. So in some sense, that's using future data. So there's something uncomfortable about that. So this risk set regression calibration is an attempt to correct that. So every time you want to impute a value for the longitudinal variable, you only use data from the past to do that. So you have to keep doing that over time. So we did a simulation study here, and we're just focusing on the estimation of a hazard parameter. So that's what alpha is. I'm just going to show you some graphs. You'll see the quality of the graphs has sort of gone up because this is sort of made by a student instead of made by me. So this is just the impact of measurement error in the longitudinal variable on the bias of the hazard parameter. And there's the least last value carried forward, right? The bias increases as the measurement error increases, and this is substantially reduced by these regression calibration methods. And obviously the less measurement error you have, the less bias you have. So compared to the last value carried forward, these two regression calibration methods improve, are better, but they're not really very different from each other. And when we looked at, you know, what's the censoring rate, how much impact did that have on the properties of these? And again, the two regression calibration methods clearly better than the last value carried forward, but they're really hard to distinguish and say one is better than the other. And one is a lot easier to fit than the other. When you just have to fit the longitudinal model once to the whole data, that's going to be a lot easier than fitting it for every time you need to impute a value. So there's some implications in how different they are. Okay. So we couldn't really detect many differences between these two methods, the ordinary regression calibration and the risk set regression calibration, and there is obviously some remaining bias, and there's a number of reasons for that. And one of them is because we're doing it in two stages. If we could estimate jointly the longitudinal model and the survival model, we'd get rid of some more of that bias, and we're working on that. Okay, so let me just say, how do these smoothing spline methods, how do they work for some of the prostate cancer data? So we did two things here. We simulated some prostate cancer-like data, and then we're going to show you some of the real data too. So this is, my goal here was just to see how good these smoothing spline models are at predicting the actual value of a PSA and the slope of PSA. Okay, I don't know. If you want to just try the lights again, it might, sorry to jump. So this is simulated data. So there's two patients here, two simulated patients. So this is top row is one patient and bottom row is another patient. On the left-hand side is the prediction of PSA and the right-hand side is the slope of PSA. Okay, so it's a simulated data, so we have a true curve, so that's the line. And then the pluses are sort of the data we happen to collect for this person according to some schedule, so you'll see they bounce around. And then we've applied these ordinary regression calibration and risk set regression calibration methods. So that every time we have a real data point, we're going to make a prediction, or an imputation, if you like, of the value of the longitudinal variable. And so for this patient, right, the blue and the green seem to follow the line quite nicely. And here, it's the same, different patient, different true curve. Maybe there's a little bit of evidence the blue's up too high there, but to follow the line. So in terms of predicting what the true value is, they seem to do fine. Once you start looking at slopes, so that's derivatives, that's going to be a harder thing to estimate, you're going to see a little more trouble. So this is, again, the solid line is the slope, and so we don't have observed data on the slope, but we do have the predictions from the models. So the green is the method which just uses all the data once and then makes a prediction at each point. And the blue is where we only use the data up to that point in time. So I guess it's probably the bottom right is a place where you can see some distinct differences. So the blue is clearly having trouble finding the real curve, whereas the green, which sort of uses all the data, so uses some future data, has better job at finding a real curve, or a true curve. So this is sort of a bias variance trade-off here. So in principle, the risk set calibration should give you less bias, but the ordinary one is going to give you less variance. Okay, so then back to some real data. Sure. Well, some more gymnastics in a minute I'll show you about. So this is some six patients again, and so these are the fits of the longitudinal model to these patients. So of course it fits well, and some of them failed and some of them are censored. And so that's okay, so this is what shows my lack of ability with PDF files.
Why didn't it rotate?
So this is estimates of the slopes for each person from that real data. So we think that's important and going to be important in the hazard model. So how well can we use this moving spline mixed model to estimate the slopes? So from the six patients, you know, we're getting what look like moderately smooth estimates of the slopes, maybe a little too wiggly. And it's interesting, they seem to level off too. So this one has slope zero, so that's the person who was just level. And this one has a higher slope, and this person here has the highest slope.
So if we just go back to, oops.
So remember the top right was the one who had the highest slope, so that sort of fits with that picture. Okay, so that's my story. So here are some sort of some ideas on sort of open issues, and some people are working on some of these already. So assessing good model fit is challenging. It's definitely robustness issues, very parametric models at the moment, and some attempts to make them non-parametric by a variety of different ways. There's some work on multivariate longitudinal data. You might have more than one biomarker measured over time. Not much work on non-Gaussian longitudinal data. And there's the algorithm, coming up with more efficient algorithms would be helpful too. Okay, thank you.